You're listening to the Full Contact Fighter Radio Network.
Hey guys, this is Dennis Kang.
This is Mr. Cripples, a.k.a. the Cat Smasher.
Hey, this is John the Natural Alessio.
Hey, this is Rashad Evans.
Hey guys, this is the Big Frog, Jeff Curran.
Hey, this is Mac Danzig.
Hey guys, this is Jason the Athlete McDonald.
Hi, this is Ivan Salvey.
Hey everybody, this is Joe Meltier, Jay Dirksen.
Hey, it's Mark Machine Hopping here.
Hey everybody, you are listening to the world's most handsome fighter on the planet. Yes, this is El Guapo, and you are listening to Full Contact Fighter Radio with Kelsey Mowat.
Thank you for tuning in to yet another edition of Full Contact Fighter Radio and Easter Sunday edition of Full Contact Fighter Radio, and joining us is the Easter Bunny Wombat Mazeros. How you doing, Jeff?
Did you just call me the Easter Bunny?
That's what I've heard. That's what people have told me.
Oh, no. If I leave some small brown round spheres in your backyard, I can assure you they're not chocolate. Do not eat. And besides, I'm a wombat. That's very different than a bunny.
Yes, yes. Well, although what you just described, a wombat is capable of doing as well.
I suppose, but yeah. I don't know. Oh, you don't find a lot of chocolate wombats around Purdy's these days.
Did you have a nice holidays, or is Easter a big thing for you and your family? Or
No, I just basically laid around at home and watched the Fight Network and ate a lot of, you know, caramel corn, and I've been eating like a pig lately. I'm like 20 pounds heavier than I should be, so every day is like Easter for me.
Right.
You know? Yeah, I don't. Why should you save one special day for eating massive amounts of chocolate when you can do it every day if you want to?
I agree.
Easter every day in my world, and Christmas, and Thanksgiving.
Yeah, I didn't do too much festive either, but I did have some chocolate eggs, so that was kind of nice.
Well, there you go.
And I watched the fights last night, of course, and we'll talk about that at the end. There's plenty to talk about, and also Pride today, and I guess by the time people listen to this, it'll be tomorrow, so it won't be a spoiler anyways, in case people are watching it as we record this, but that's impossible for them to listen to it. Never mind me.
You're just confusing me with some sort of time travel
yes,
stuff.
Yeah. You need Stephen, all right. Pull out some Stephen Hawking books here. And
yeah, all right then.
We got Jeff Osborne coming on the program, Bodog Fight's new commissioner, a longtime MMA promoter, observer, writer, etc. Jeff Osborne will be on the show. Talk about what's going on for Bodog Fight's card next week. Some interesting thoughts from Jeff in that interview. We did that a couple days ago, so we'll air that tonight. And then, of course, like I said, Jeff, we'll get into the UFC. And plenty to talk about on that front. So stay tuned. You're listening to Full Contact Fighter Radio.
When you think mixed martial arts, there's only one name that instills fear. Fedor Emelianenko. Watch two MMA legends when the number one ranked heavyweight fighter Fedor Emelianenko takes on one of the top pound-for-pound fighters in the world. In Bodog Fight, Fedor Emelianenko versus Matt Lindley. Plus, see Fedor's brother Alexander Emelianenko battle Eric Pele. And more Saturday, April 14th, only on pay-per-view. Visit BodogFight.com/PPV for details.
You don't have to be a champion to dress like one. With a Full Contact Fighter shop, we have all the MMA gear that you see so many of your favorite professional fighters wearing. NHB Extreme Fight shorts, camouflage board shorts, corduroy and camo hats, hooded sweatshirts, to the classic FCF t-shirts, Full Contact Fighter clothing is the number one mixed martial arts brand that any MMA fan must have. Now open is the FCF sticker and banner shop. We have all your favorite IFL team clothing, plus a great assortment of low-priced Pride and MMA DVDs are now all available at the FCF shop. To check it out, head to www.fcfighter.com, pick up the latest edition of the FCF paper, or call 516-676-0033. That number, again, 516-676-0033. Full Contact Fighter. The undefeated, no-holds-barred new source of the world.
You're listening to the Full Contact Fighter Radio Network.
Joining Full Contact Fighter Radio is Bodog Fight's Jeff Osborne. Jeff, how are you doing this afternoon?
Doing great, guys. How are you doing?
I can't complain, thanks. My first question, Jeff, is in regards to a recent announcement by Bodog Fight that you've taken on some more responsibilities on top of your prior ones with that organization. Can you maybe just fill us in a little bit about what you're doing for Bodog Fight now? I believe the word being thrown around was commissioner.
Yeah, nothing like Mr. McMahon on WWE or anything like that. But, you know, there's always room for improvement. And, you know, Bodog is a company that has millions and millions of dollars in backing it. But I think they realize that they need to have, you know, three or four or five people who've been involved in the fight industry for a long time, helping them, you know, achieve what they want to achieve. And, you know, me and Miguel and, you know, he got into the position of being matchmaker and called me up and said, well, you want to do commentary? And then I, you know, started making little suggestions here and there, and, you know, how character development and everything is the key to success of every fight company. And before you know it, you know, I've, you know, I can't keep my mouth shut long enough I voiced my opinion on a few things, and I think they, some people took notice, and next thing I know, I was getting more phone calls to do more duties, so.
Well, Jeff, tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get involved in the fight game to begin with, especially MMA in particular?
I had actually discovered a form of MMA back in the late 80s, Shudo, I'm sure most people are familiar with. Actually practiced and trained in Shudo and what was originally called shoot boxing in Japan, which was basically known more today as Sanshou. I had two or three kind of Sanshou shoot boxing amateur fights, whatever you want to call it. At the time, I was also involved in pro wrestling and walked away from doing pro wrestling and running shows around here as soon as I found Pancrase and the Ultimate Fighting Championship and graduated from the glorious life of pro wrestling into mixed martial arts, started Hook and Shoot, and I think I actually started like a publication or an email newsletter in 1994 and took that to video like 3 years later. And in the course of doing that, I started running some small shows, and they kind of snowballed into bigger shows and basically jumping ahead 4, 5, 6 years, you know, now we're here. I don't even advertise the shows anymore here, and they always seem to get bigger and bigger and sell out. Mm-hmm. Yet, you know, nobody hears of them. But
well, tell us a little bit about how it seems that there's two ways that the MMA promotions have been compared to. Like, one is a sort of boxing paradigm, but the other has always been, and it seems no matter how people try, they can't get away being compared to the professional wrestling paradigm. So how did you make your way as a promoter in between those two?
Well, it's, at first I was sold on the, this is all sport, this should be a sport, and I've, you know, you just get smart, and I'm sure half the people may agree, half the people may totally hate what I say, but I still don't think we're at the level of being a sport yet. I think we're years away from that. I think I go for entertainers versus, you know, I don't want to put a guy who's 20-0 against another guy who's 20-0 just for the sake of saying, hey, I got two good fighters to go against each other. And, you know, occasionally you just get a snooze fest, and, mm-hmm. and I'd rather have, you know, entertaining fighters go against each other, but they're so few of them out there that they, you know, they don't know how to speak on the mic like a pro wrestler. Now, granted, you shouldn't be coming out there like, you know, The Rock or Stone Cold Steve Austin every time, but there's a right time to turn it up and do it and become a character, but so many guys have trouble with it. And I still go back to the stereotypical, you know, watching The Ultimate Fighter 1 year, I think there was a prerequisite where you had to have a shaved head or discolored hair and 500 tattoos and black trunks just to get on the show.
Well, that's probably where Kelsey is sitting in his apartment right now in Vancouver. So
yeah, absolutely.
Don't get too personal with the descriptions. Sorry to interrupt
pants,
you,
guys. I never wear pants when I do radio. So.
Well, let me ask you about that, Jeff, though, as far as you're talking about, you believe it's still a few years away from being a sport. So you're saying that you think that the character development to further your promotions or to further Bodog Fight is a necessity based on trying to attract fans? Is that what you're saying?
I think that a viewer has to, in some way, identify with the people. I think that's the first season of Ultimate Fighter really opened a lot of people's eyes. You have 13 weeks to love or hate someone. Mm-hmm. That's a long time, and it all culminated and started building big, big numbers for the UFC. And I said it from the beginning, the first people to get this on television and put it in front of, you know, 2, 3, 4 million new people every week and start developing. of time, they're going to love him. I mean, I personally think Forrest Griffin's been one of the, you know, he's just a fun-loving guy. He's like the guy who lives next door you see mowing his lawn.
Yeah.
A lot of people can relate to him, and he's gone through some hardships and stuff like that. You know, their three or four biggest draws are, you know, Chuck Liddell, Tito Ortiz, Randy Couture, and Ken Shamrock. They need to be, you know, I'm not telling UFC what to do by any means, because they're obviously doing something right. But you can't rely on the top four guys all the time, and you got to bring new guys up.
And that show really seemed to be stacked with personalities, if you think about it. Not only the Forrest types, but you had the sort of typical heel like Chris Lieben and the sort of jock and Josh Koscheck and the sort of spaced out new wave dude in Diego.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there you have three or four different extremes of people. And the way they interact with each other, I mean, it tells a story. I'm all about the stories. I said it from the beginning. I mean, did anyone really, and this is no disrespect to Ken Shamrock, but did anyone think that Ken was going to come out and kill Tito in this third fight?
Mm-hmm.
No, you tuned in, and a lot of people did, because of, you wanted to see what happened after they fought. Are they going to shake hands, or is the feud going to continue? And obviously, with Ken's comment at the end, you know, we made a lot of money together. That tells me something there. So, but I want to be entertained. I know that it's a fight. I know it's this and that, but I want to be entertained first and foremost.
Well, in mentioning what Ken said after, though, do you think there's kind of a danger? It seems like fighters more and more go on public record saying that a lot of the things they said, perhaps disparaging things that they might have said about their opponent pre-fight, they'll blatantly admit after the fact it was solely to hype up the fight. Do you think fans might catch wise to that eventually and start tuning out these kind of the drama that may unfold before fights?
I think they will, but, I mean, let's be honest. We all know pro wrestling is worked and fictitious and everything, but, you know, I still watch the stuff.
Mm.
But, you know, this, I go back to the entertainment factor and the fact that, you know, Matt Hughes and Hayato Sakurai in UFC just, to me, completely killed Sakurai. And I know that goes back about 5 years ago, but here you have the two top fighters in the world, and there was no character development or build-up of Sakurai, and nobody knew who he was, so he comes in and gets brutalized and is never seen again. So, you know, how special was Sakurai to all the viewers? Matt Hughes, before The Ultimate Fighter, couldn't sell a pay-per-view to save their lives. That Matt Hughes had the two lowest purchase pay-per-views in the history of the Fertittas buying the UFC. All of a sudden he's on TV and they manipulate a few key shots of Matt playing cards here and there, and everybody on the world hates him, and now they're paying to see him every time he fights on pay-per-view. So they're obviously doing some character development there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do you balance then as a promoter? So obviously you have some influence now with the direction of Bodog. Do you look for guys like that, or do you do media training, or do you do coaching? Because all professional athletes now have basically media training, and one of the disadvantages to MMA guys is that, you know, they spend 5 years in the gym and never talk to anyone, and they get a camera in their face and they kind of choke up. So what do you do to keep the integrity of MMA as a sport and as a competition, but increase that entertainment value?
I work with a few of the fighters on their interviews and trying to drive a point across. And the main thing that I tell people is be original, but yet, you know, still be yourself. If you want to take it to the next level of entertainment, that's totally up to you, because it's your show as a fighter. Any fighter out there who, there's just so many, again, the stereotypical shaved head, tattoo, black trunk wearing fighter, it's just, you're not going to leave any kind of mark on the people who watch you or anything like that. It's just very hard to find. find the person who naturally has that, like a Forrest Griffin or a Tito Ortiz or someone like that who is... Tito's the double-edged sword. I mean, he's absolutely perfect in who I'd put on top of any show because half the people hate him, half the people love him.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
You always will pay to see him.
Yeah.
And that has been evident. But main thing I tell them, hey, look, be original, be entertaining, be different. Show me something I haven't seen before.
Well, Jeff, in the upcoming pay-per-view for Bodog Fight, you've got, in the main event, you've got kind of, I would say, almost two contrasting personalities. You've got Matt Lindland, who's very outspoken, a fighter. We've had him on the show, and he's never one for loss of words to share his thoughts on a variety of topics. And then there's someone like Fedor Emelianenko, who maybe fans don't know on a personal level as much, but he's got a huge following based on his skills. Is that main event, do you think, going to be a big draw for Bodog Fight? And do you think people are going to tune in for the pay-per-view, Jeff?
I don't know. It's hard to say. It's hard to get a new company off the ground as a big pay-per-view entity. Nobody, I don't care what anyone says. I don't care if I get in trouble. When there is no competition to UFC right now. We're not going to draw the numbers that they do. Anyone who starts a company with $50 trillion, billion in opposition of the UFC is not going to get, you know, the numbers that they do. But you can, you know, not going to compete with them, but you can be in the same market and attract a lot of those people.
Mm-hmm.
Fedor, in my honest opinion, is the best heavyweight fighter out there.
Yeah.
I know this is going to be a 205 and all that good stuff, and, you know, we'll see. Probably Lindland put Fedor on his back, but, you know, Fedor submitted a lot of people. The guy hasn't lost in 20-something fights, so... It's a pretty long win streak for Fedor. Lindland has his work cut out for him, so.
Yeah.
So what would you tell someone like Fedor who has no obvious human personality whatsoever? Just go with that.
Yeah, there's certain fighters who can get over on fighting alone. You know, you have Fedor who just completely kills people and can do everything to back up his physical attributes. He does it. You know, there's guys out there who, you know, are mediocre fighters who may have championship belts who people just don't care about them. They don't even want to see them fight. I'm not saying there's anything you can do to salvage that. I mean, I would tell Fedor to do nothing but other than just keep penetrating people in the way that he does. So, can I say that on here?
Sure.
Not everybody has personality, but some of them have the fight skill to be entertaining athletically, where they lack in other departments. So,
well, can you tell? And speaking about competing with the UFC, can you tell us a little bit more about the nature of the strategic agreement that Elite XE and K1 Heroes and reportedly Bodog, but not we haven't heard much more about Bodog. So, is Bodog in that alliance, and what is it, exactly does it look like?
I don't know for sure. There's still things going on in the infrastructure of Bodog Fight that, you know, you have television people, you have upper management people, then you have fight people. So it's a three-way street. And to me, I don't like calling anything an alliance because to me, if I'm on the outside looking in, that shows me weakness. Like, oh my gosh, we have to align with someone. We got to team up to beat this big bully or whatever. And, you know, I was told that there was going to be an alternative press release put out this week.
Yeah, there was.
Bodog Fight regarding that. So
there was, yeah.
I think the alliance thing is something that, you know, I would never use as far as, you know, that we may be working with one another, but I don't want to form any kind of alliance because they never, ever work.
As a longtime observer of the sport and being involved directly in the sport as a promoter, Jeff, and even working for the UFC, curious to hear your thoughts on when the news finally came after months of speculation that the Fertittas had bought Pride.
Hey, there's nothing like owning and buying out your competitor.
Mm-hmm.
If it's done properly, and, you know, I don't want to go back to the pro wrestling stuff. You know, a lot of MMA people don't like it. They think pro wrestling's stupid or whatever, but Vince McMahon completely screwed up the purchase of WCW in conjunction. conjunction with his WWE, and it should have been ran separately and took 3, 4, 5 years to culminate. Instead, he rushed right into it and was doing interpromotional fights the next week, or interpromotional matches. I think that this should be something special for the UFC and Pride, in the fact that maybe once a year you have Goldberg and Rogan put on some tuxedos and have the big, you know, their version of WrestleMania.
Yeah.
And then have the Pride, top Pride guys against the top UFC guys. I don't think that they should rush it or anything like that. I think they should take their sweet time and develop Pride on a larger scale in the U.S.
Uh-huh. Well, what do you think the implications of this this kind of cohesion between the organizations, what kind of implications do you think that has for fighters in general?
I think right now, there about 6 months ago, it was a fighter's market. I mean, there were more groups popping up with millions of dollars in California in a 3 or 4 month period than anyone ever imagined, and they're all outbidding each other for, you know, John Doe making 4 or 5 times, sometimes 6 times what he would make in the UFC for his first fight. Nobody's ever seen the guy outside of California.
Yeah.
With UFC buying up all the other stuff, and, you know, they're going to kind of control the price, and let's face it, I mean, people may complain about that and say, well, fighters should make this and make that and make this much money, and but if you own the company, you'd probably do the same thing and doing a, you know, scaling pay down and starting the right way, which they have done. I'm not saying I'm not going to go into a company and spend, oh, well, you know, this guy's worth $100,000. Let's give him $100,000 for his first fight. I think UFC has done the right thing, and there's no shortage. You know, this is another fighter issue. There's no shortage of fighters who will fight for $2,000 and $2,000.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe they will monopolize. I don't even want to use that word. I just think they've more of strategized than anything. So.
Do you think? Reflecting back on the sort of pro wrestling model, it was always one of the biggest criticisms from outside of pro wrestling was always that the fighters basically had no union, they had no representation, and they were taken advantage of. Basically, the top tier fighters made a lot of money, but if you ever stepped out of the company line, you're basically gone. Or if you got severely injured, you're basically gone, and basically had to fend for yourself. So, is there a way to protect fighters in MMA if there is a quote unquote monopoly?
I don't think so. That was my complaint for a long time, and the fact that, you know, this isn't a personal attack against Dana or anyone, because, to be honest, I felt the same way about certain people, but a promoter or someone like Dana who, you know, punished, in Jen's words, you know, a few years ago, Jen's Pulver, he's like, I guess, you know, I want to go back to the UFC. I want to be in there, but Dana's punishing me for leaving. You know, if that's the case, is this really a sport? When someone in control and like a Don King situation who can keep you from fighting for as long as he wants to. But, you know, thank God Dana let all these guys back in, because it's really turned into a positive for everyone. Whether Tito or Dana hate each other or not, it's great that Tito's back.
Yeah.
But that, to me, you know, when you can control, I don't know if there should be a union or not. You know, it'd be nice to see the fighters taken care of. That's one thing I worry about. You know, 10, 20 years from now, these guys making big money and not putting any of it back. So,
well, do you think that becomes more and more likely when the company becomes bigger and bigger, and it's no longer a sort of cult of personality, you know, more than one person's whims about who he likes and who he doesn't like?
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's going to be even more companies that come out and try to. You know, I've seen it a million times. I've been running shows now for 11, 12 years, and everybody comes out with these big, giant dreams of we're going to be just like UFC, and we got this much money. Then they really
Jeff, before we let you go, I wanted to just get back to the pay-per-view really quickly. There's a couple fights on there. Of course, Fedor and Matt, that fight, the main event is grabbing all the headlines, but we had Nick Thompson on the show earlier this week, and he's fighting Eddie Alvarez, which is a great welterweight fight, and you've got Alexander Emelianenko taking on Eric Pelle, which is going to be could be a great slugfest as well. What are your thoughts on those two fights, and what about some of the fights that are going to be the finalist bouts from Season 2? Are you maybe point a couple of those out that you think are going to be really entertaining for people who get the pay-per-view?
The women's stuff, I'm telling you, when next season starts airing, the Molly Helso Karina Dam fight was incredible. The women fights, I feel, are always entertaining because they know they're on pay-per-view. They know they're probably only going to fight two or three times a year max, and they lay it all out there. As far as Lindland and Fedor, I think Lindland is pretty hungry. I think that people are discounting him enough that, you know, this could go either way. I mean, I would venture to say that Fedor has a 60-40 edge, and again, no disrespect to Matt or anything like that, but that's going to be an interesting fight. I like to see Lindland put Fedor on his back, but, you know, then again, Fedor is actually decent from his back and all this stuff. So that's going to be interesting. The Pelé and Alexander fight, somebody's probably going to get knocked out. And then Nick Thompson, Eddie Alvarez is probably the most evenly matched fight on there. I think that this is a definite another step up for Eddie Alvarez, who, in my opinion, is the most underrated 170-pound fighter in the world. This is a big test for him because Nick Thompson is probably the most improved 170-pound fighter that I've seen in recent years. So I don't even know which way that one's going to go. I can't even comment on that one.
Just before you leave, Jeff, what happened to your big heavyweight from season one, the big black guy who could do cartwheels?
Rinaldi?
Mario?
Yeah, Mario Rinaldi, wasn't it?
Yeah, Mario Rinaldi. He fought on this past season that hasn't aired yet. Not allowed to say it. Fought another heavyweight. But yeah, he'll be back. He's always entertaining. Any 300-pounder can do a backflip and a cartwheel and all that good stuff. I mean, but yeah, he had a. I think he fought Roy Nelson. And it was a good fight. I wish I could comment on it, but I can't.
Yeah.
But, interesting.
Jeff,
my last comment is that, and I feel free to make this comment because Calvin grew up in Saskatchewan, and so did I. Why don't you build him up using your pro wrestling insight into sort of a crazy crackpot recluse millionaire, like Enter the Dragon type of guy. Make him dress up in golden robes and have a bevy of exotic looking ladies around him, and fighters thrown in prison and stuff like that.
I think Calvin has his own unique.
Or is that what everyday life is like?
Yeah, it kind of looks like that. I mean, he shows up with some of the hottest women I've ever seen, and he sits and he actually does watch the fights, and he was there for almost all the fights in Costa Rica, and the thing about the Russian show when we were in the makeshift ballroom there was there were only probably 150, 200 people max there at all times, so it was kind of dead, and I think it killed the mood of some of the fights. In Costa Rica, they're much more lively and by far the best fights that I've seen in a long, long time. I mean, when you can run 10 fights and get two or three of them that you can say, man, those are really good fights, that's a good day. When they were running 10 fights a day there, 6, 7, and sometimes 8 of the fights in a day were all good fights. So that's quite an accomplishment. I mean, I'm not just saying that because I work for them or anything. If I was sitting in that crowd, I would say, damn, there's been some good fights today. So watch next season,
Is that going to start right on the heels of this one?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. And I think the first episode from Costa Rica has some of one of the best fights I've seen in a long time.
Well, Jeff, we appreciate you taking some time on your busy schedule. Of course, the Bodog Fight View coming up April 14th. Jeff Osborne, thanks again for coming on the show, and we'll talk to you soon.
Hey, thank you, guys.
A person who gets punched in the face for a living doesn't know what fear is. Pain doesn't exist if you train more than 30 hours a week. Someone who fights with broken bones has a totally different definition of agony. Bodog Fight mixed martial artists know that fear, pain, and agony won't last. But the glory of having your hand raised at the end of the fight, that lasts forever. Bodog Fight, St. Petersburg. Don't miss any mixed martial arts action. Check your local listings or visit BodogFights.com for details.
The best coverage of the toughest fighters in the toughest sport can only be found in Full Contact Fighter. For over a decade now, FCF has been bringing mixed martial arts fans across the globe in-depth reporting of the world's greatest sport. From Brazil, Japan, Europe, Canada, and the U.S., FCF brings you all the fighter bios, event reports, training and technique tips any avid MMA fan would want. Every month, 12 times a year, we do it. Full Contact Fighter is your best source for MMA coverage. Pick up the latest edition of the paper by subscribing at www.fcfighter.com or call 516-676-0033. Again, the number 516-676-0033. Full Contact Fighter, the undefeated, no-holds-barred new source of the world, and when you call, tell them that FCF Radio sent you.
Hey, this is Kurt Batman Pellegrino, and you're listening to Full Contact Fighter Radio.
Welcome back to Full Contact Fighter Radio, and Wombat, plenty to talk about, like we mentioned off the top of the show, and last night, let's get into the shocking news. Matt Serra, of course, stopping George St. Pierre, everybody is talking about it. Wombat, your thoughts? Are you still in shock or not so much?
Oh, I'm still in shock. I mean, I did not expect that to happen. I mean, to me, with Matt Serra wearing the belt, it looks like a Teddy Ruxpin wearing the belt. It just looks, or Joe Pesci, it looks like Joe Pesci wearing the belt. It just looks weird. But I mean, Matt Serra, he gets in there, and you see guys like Matt Serra, like Hermes Franca, these guys, they go in and they don't really box. They just swing for the fences. And if it hits you, your day is over. That's it. You're done, more or less, because they're just, you know, they throw it from their heel, they twist their whole body. And that's what happened. I mean, George St. Pierre got nailed, and it put him on Queer Street, you know, or as it would be in Quebec, La Rue Queer, I suppose. And he just never recovered, you know, and Matt Serra smelled blood and went right after him. I mean, the same thing almost happened to Carol Parisian when he fought Matt Serra. Serra nailed him right off the hop. And Parisian fell right onto his beak and was barely able to recover, you know, and Matt Serra was all over him, you know. I mean, it's one of those things. You want a dude swinging for the fences with 4-ounce gloves, and he hit him with kind of almost, it was more of a forearm shot on the back of the dome there. So
Yeah. What
do you want? You know, shit happens. And, you know, personally, I think if St. Pierre and Serra were to fight again another 10 times, that St. Pierre would probably win 9 times out of 10. But when you get a guy swinging for the fences like that, you have to be careful. And I think St. Pierre probably should have taken him down and pounded him out, but, you know, what the hell do I know?
Well, you know, the one thing, you're talking about Matt Serra and his belt, et cetera, and I definitely agree with you. It's hard not to be kind of happy for the guy. I mean, you know, I'm a Canadian, and I make no bones about the fact I've always cheered for George St. Pierre to an extent, wanted him to do well. But we've had Matt Serra on the show as well, and he seems like a really, really nice guy. And so I had so much respect for him during the last season of Ultimate Fighter. It seemed like he had a decent head on his shoulder. So on one hand, it's kind of a nice Cinderella story. He's the Cinderella man he joked about before the fights. I think it was on the Fight Network. He called himself the Cinderella man. And in a sense, that's true. You know, the one thing is when you watch the fight, you watch the tape, it looked to me like George, he said in a couple post-fight interviews that he felt a little tentative, a little tight, I think he put it. And when you watch it, it almost looks like he was doing everything probably what the game plan had called for. Stand back, make Matt Serra come in, try to throw some kicks, get the better of the stand. I think you're right. No one would think that George St. Pierre was going to lose to Matt Serra via striking.
Right.
But
there's
a couple stiff right hooks to the body that seemed to land on George, and then you really kind of saw him tighten up, and it seemed like at that point there was maybe something going off in his mind as to, you know, what's Serra doing? He's hit me a couple times. He's not even trying to take me down, and I don't know. I don't know if he started to overthink and just got caught or what, but it was a weird sight, was it not, at the end to see George struggling and to take those shots at the end? It was something that no one has seen happen to George St. Pierre, at least in his MMA career.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing with St. Pierre is whenever he goes into fight, he kind of knows what his opponent is going to bring to the table. Like, when he fought Hughes, he said, I beat Hughes because I knew what Hughes' game plan was going to be. He's going to pretend to strike with me, then he's going to try to take me down. I mean, going in against Matt Serra, I guarantee you St. Pierre didn't think that Matt Serra was going to stand and trade with him. That's probably what he, that's not what he was preparing for. So when he got in there, like you say, I mean, he was preparing for Serra to try and tackle him like a man covered in bees and also on fire, you know, like I'm rushing across the octagon at him like something out of, like, one of the dead. But he didn't. He stood there and he was just swinging away with haymakers. And Matt Serra said it subsequently in his post-fight interviews as well. He said, you know, I don't blame people for thinking I'm going to get my head knocked off because, I mean, people don't know what I'm capable of doing standing. He says, I do this in sparring, but I haven't really done this in too many of my fights, you know?
Yeah.
So it was just kind of like, you know, the UFC is like the unexpected fighting championship now, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty ridiculous. It's pretty insane. But, I mean, getting back to your point about Matt Serra, yeah, I mean, it is a huge Cinderella story or whatever you want to call it, you know, the Rocky Balboa thing. He seems like a really cool cat. And, it's neat. But, I mean, I feel kind of bad for Matt Serra because he was fighting at 155, and then they eliminated that weight division. He went up to 170, and then they brought it back. So, realistically, you know, dude, I think should be fighting at 155 more than 170. So, you know, I mean, what's going to happen now? He'll probably fight Hughes, or he'll probably fight Josh Koscheck, or whomever. And, I mean, hey, Matt Serra's a cool cat, but I don't think he can hang with those guys. I think he's going to get pounded out, and then he'll probably drop to 155 again if he continues fighting, I think.
Well, yeah, I asked him on the show, we had him on, and he maintained, he echoed some of the same sentiments that Carlos Newton has, that as he got older, that he's way too broad, has too much muscle, he's gotten to a point where you just can't see himself getting down to 155. But, I mean, guys have said that in the past and then dropped down a weight class. And you touched on my next question. Is that what you think is going to happen? You think we're going to see Matt Serra versus Matt Hughes next, just if for no other reason than the fact that it's a ready-made fight already. There's already bad blood between those two. You think that's what's going to happen next?
No, I think what's going to happen next is they're going to have Matt Hughes versus Georges St-Pierre.
You think?
And the winner of that, and then they're probably going to have the winner of that fight for the belt. And I think the next person that Matt Serra fights, it will be the winner of that fight. And then Josh Koscheck will get his title shot against the winner of whatever, you know, whoever sorts out of that mess. Probably St-Pierre again, I think. So, I mean, I personally think that you're going to see Hughes versus St-Pierre again in the near future. You know, because you know how much the UFC loves rematches, the old trilogy thing.
Yeah.
And I think the winner of that fight's probably going to get a shot at Serra, personally.
You know, this, as you said, the unexpected fighting championship, and is this something, Wombat, that MMA is always going to have to deal with? I mean, contrary to the sport, something like boxing, where you have these firmly entrenched champions that last sometimes for years at a time, undisputed champions. Is this just something that MMA, they're going to have to realize as promoters, the UFC Pride, well, it's the same promoters now, but that, you know, they invest a lot in Georges St-Pierre, and don't get me wrong, he's still going to be a huge star, the future is very bright for him, but do you think in some sense that the fans, even though we all consider ourselves experts, armchair experts, or whatever we're called, that when we see these upsets, I mean, maybe we should face facts that this is MMA, and we should all get ready, get used to these upsets, because they're going to happen all the time in MMA, it seems.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's what makes MMA so exciting, is anything can happen. I mean, they get in there, and literally anything can happen. There can be submissions, knockouts, throws, slams, whatever. You know, and especially with those 4-ounce gloves, anybody is capable of KOing anybody. And or you're capable of almost TKOing them, and if they're on Wacky Street, then submitting them when they're still, you know, counting the birds that are floating around their head or whatever. So, I mean, the thing about MMA is it's not about fight per fight. It's about what's going to happen consistently. Like, for example, if St. Pierre were to fight Serra 10 times, who would win the majority of the time? Well, I think it would probably be, you know, Georges St. Pierre or whatever. You know what I mean? But on per fight occasions, it's like rolling dice. You don't know. I mean, you have two dice, you look at them, it's trying to, try to predict which one's going to come up boxcar and which one's going to come up snake eye, so to speak. It's kind of hard to do, you know?
Yeah.
But over time, some fighters will do better than others, but on just one fight occasions, you know, anybody's capable of beating anybody on one given night. You know what I mean? Like, you could put me in the ring with Fedor, and for all I know, he could take one step towards me, slip and break his ankle, and then I'd be dancing around collecting my billion-dollar check. You know? Like,
yeah.
It's completely possible. You know? So, who knows? That's what makes MMA so damn exciting, is that you don't get guys like boxing in there wearing 16-ounce gloves or, you know, these other sports where it's kind of know what's going to happen and then you just got to watch it play out or whatever. Anything can happen in MMA, and that's kind of what makes it cool.
Well, there's one fighter who I think it was loved by some for this and hated by others for this, and that was Diego Sanchez doing the destiny speech, how he believed he was destined to retire undefeated and to be the undisputed welterweight champion, greatest champion of all time. And like I said, some people loved him for that confidence and some people disliked him. Going up against a guy like Josh Koscheck, who's not always been a loss for words either, your thoughts on that fight, Wombat? Some people said it was boring, but you know what? For me, I was on the edge of my seat, I think, just because there was so much at stake in that fight.
Well, it goes back to one of those, the question is it a fighter's job to win his fight, or is it a fighter's job to entertain the crowd? You know, Josh Koscheck went in there to win. He had a game plan. He executed it, and he won. When he took Diego Sanchez down at the end of the first round, he nearly got swept and ended up on the bottom. And then he's like, "Oh, well, screw this! I'm just going to pound him out." And that's what he did. You know, I mean, the crowd wants the slam. They want to see the scramble. They want to see all the high risk maneuvers and whatever. But realistically, Koscheck went in there to hand Sanchez a loss. He didn't go in there to entertain a crowd. And he said that much in his post-fight interview. He was like, "Yeah, go ahead, boo if you want, but the dude's 19-1." You know, and you kind of got to respect that. I still think it was it a barn burner? I mean, it wasn't the Huerta versus Garcia fight. That one was crazy,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was still fairly exciting. I mean, you know, Koscheck throwing some high kicks. He was jabbing well. He was throwing hard rights. I think Diego Sanchez was the one who was being a little tentative, a little gun shy, because I mean he knew he wasn't going to take down Koscheck. He didn't even get a chance to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, what can you say? I mean, Koscheck had a game plan. He executed it, and now Sanchez is 19-1. So there you go. I mean, I in my predictions on another website or whatever, I picked Sanchez to win, but that's because I was kind of told by some people that I had to do that. But I thought Josh Koscheck was going to pull it off. I really seriously did, and he didn't. And I, you know, props to him. Kudos to him. He seems like a cool cat. Did you see Sanchez push him at the weigh-ins?
Yeah, yeah.
That just seems like kind of a dickhead thing to do, you know. And there you go. You know, the gods of karma are a bitch.
Yeah, I thought that this was going to be an extremely tough test for Diego, and I always went back to the Johnny Alessio fight. Diego never was able to take John Alessio down, and I used that as an example that if Koscheck's stand-up is improved where he can beat Diego standing, that there's no way that Diego was going to get Josh Koscheck to the ground, and he
right.
didn't even try. It was almost like it was a pre-gone conclusion that he knew not to even bother. Where does Koscheck fit in the picture then, Jeff? You think we're going to see him? They said that this could possibly for a title shot down the line. Are we going to see Josh Koscheck against Matt Serra or anyone top echelon soon?
I think they're going to give him maybe one or two more fights. Honestly, what I think is going to happen is they're going to have St. Pierre fight Hughes again, and the winner of that will get a shot at Serra, and they'll probably have Koscheck fight, who knows, you know, and then they'll have them fight. The title holder. I don't think they're going to give Koscheck a title shot right away.
Mm-hmm.
Really seriously don't. Because I think, I think Koscheck might be able, well, I think Koscheck would probably be able to beat Hughes and beat Serra. I don't think he'd be able to beat St. Pierre. But I mean, you know, again, this is a guy, I mean, what do I know? I mean, I was, how many fights did I get wrong in the last one? Three? I mean, I didn't think that Serra was going to win. I didn't think that, on my predictions, I said that Sanchez was going to win, but I didn't really believe that. And then, what happened to the old, did Heath Herring fight Brad Imus, or what happened with that?
Yeah, Heath Herring won by unanimous decision.
Well, there you go, I picked that one right too.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm a freaking genius, who knows?
Well,
I think Koscheck is going to get a title shot, but not for one or two more fights.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you. I think against Hughes, he's got an excellent chance just because it seems like Josh's stand-up is really, really good.
Matt, really good.
Yeah, Matt wouldn't be able to take him to the ground, but I do think, despite George's performance against Matt last night, I think I'd still favor George St. Pierre versus Koscheck just for that simple matter that I think George could beat him standing.
Well, that's just it. I mean, St. Pierre would go in there with the same strategy against Koscheck that he used against Hughes. He would say, "I know this guy wants to take me down," and St. Pierre probably would have better stand-up than Koscheck. But that being said, those head kicks that Koscheck was throwing, those were terrifying. Those were terrifying. You get a guy who's a national champion wrestler who's throwing head kicks like that, that is a bad, bad combination. That is a bad night for anybody. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's a really scary opponent. I'm going to have nightmares about that.
The other fight I wanted to talk about was the Mike Swick, Yushin Okami, and, you know, we just finished going on about how we as MMA fans, everyone should expect the unexpected in MMA, and here we go again at the UFC. I mean, they've got Nate Marquardt going to have a title shot with Anderson Silva, a fighter Marquardt who's extremely talented that I would venture to say 80-85% of UFC fans in North America, the average MMA fan, casual MMA fan, probably has never even seen Nate Marquardt fight for that, because they don't put his fights on pay-per-view. And then you got a guy like Yushin Okami who's beaten Rory Singer, Caleb Starnes, and Ellen Belcher before he fights Mike Swick, two guys who are fairly notable Ultimate Fighter names. And then we see Okami, he goes through Mike Swick, an extremely, I thought, impressive performance. And here we go again, Wombat. We've got another fighter now that probably a lot of people don't even know who the hell he is.
Who's that? Nate Marquardt?
Yushin Okami.
Yeah, well, they didn't televise his fights, you know, because for whatever reason, they put them in the prelims. But I thought he did really, really well against Mike Swick. And again, this is one of those times when my predictions on another website, I wrote that I thought Swick was going to win, but I didn't truly believe that. There are, believe it or not, when I write those things, there are powers of influence exerted upon them. So sometimes what ends up on sometimes what ends up on the web isn't exactly what I believe was going to happen. And I thought Okami was gonna take it, and he dragged Swick to the ground, and he beat him out. I mean, I thought that's what he was going to do. I mean, Okami, I mean, the guy beat Alan Belcher, he beat Caleb Starnes, you know, he beat Rory Singer, and I think Mike Swick's probably around, if you add up all his skills, probably around the same level. And Okami's one of those guys where he just drags you to the ground and pounds you in the face, you know. I mean, I'm amazed they let that fight go on as long as they did. Okami was mounted on him for like a minute and a half, whacking him in the noodle. Like, what do you want, you know?
Yeah.
But the Nate Marquardt, Anderson Silva fight, I see Nate Marquardt winning that one. I mean, you know, the UFC is going to be a very interesting position pretty soon, because all their title holders are going to be people that the average UFC fan isn't terribly, terribly familiar with. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're going to have Sean Sherk. You're going to have at 170 Matt Serra, at 185 Nate Marquardt. Chuck Liddell is going to be at 205. And then the heavyweight will probably be, I guess either maybe Mirko Krokop pretty soon. Who knows? Assuming that Couture can beat him. I mean, assuming he can beat Couture or whatever, but that's another fight where I have no idea what the hell is going on.
Well, it was interesting with Okami. The Caleb Starnes fight wasn't, like I said, it wasn't on pay-per-view. I watched it on a UFC On Demand, and there's one point, I can't remember if it's between the first and second round or second and third, but Caleb, the corner is talking to Caleb, and they're kind of getting on him, and Caleb Starnes says, you know what, I'm paraphrasing, but essentially says that the guy is crazy, crazy strong, and that there's no way he's going to be able to win. I think he was talking about a stand-up exchange at the time, but again with the Mike Swick fight, you can hear the corner, and I don't know what they were saying to him, but Mike Swick echoed those same sentiments. And I mean, this guy, like I said, he goes through two extremely talented fighters. I mean, Mike Swick is no joke. Caleb Starnes is an extremely talented fighter as well, and not to even mention Alan Belcher and Rory Singer. But this guy, it seems like that's what you hear, and you can see when he gets those clinches. It's very hard to stay up. And I kind of thought that, I know he looked maybe gassed at the end against Mike Swick, but it almost seemed to me like he was taking a little something off his punches. Maybe it was just being gassed, but maybe he just thought that someone was going to jump in. I don't know.
Yeah, he was beating the crap out of Swick, that's for sure. And about that power, I mean, it's that same, you see guys, and this predominantly comes for some reason from judo guys like Fedor and Kazuhiro Nakamura, they get this weird strength. I think it's from just like body-on-body contact, constant lifting and throwing people and whatnot. And, you know, wrestlers have it, you know, also to a certain extent. But for some reason, you see it a lot in guys like judo guys like Fedor and Kazuhiro Nakamura and Okami. And it's really odd. And they just throw people around. And once they get on top of you, they give you a really, really hard time. And he just beat the holy living hell out of Swick. And especially when a dude's mounted on you and the fence is right there, so you can't even bridge him off because he can use the fence for base. I mean, that is a bad time. That is bad news. That is not good. You know.
Yeah.
So, and Swick paid the price. I mean, he did his best. I mean, Swick, if really realistically, if he was going to win that fight, he would have won it like he always does in like the first minute or so. Because it seems like the further he goes along in a fight, the less well he does. I mean, you know, when he fought David Loazo, he was winning. He always did well in rounds one and two, and then Loazo, he kind of came back in the third round. And when he was fighting Chris Lieben, have you seen that fight? Right off the hop, Mike Swick's doing really, really well against Chris Lieben, but then as the fight kind of goes along, Chris Lieben starts to get better and better and better, and then all of a sudden he smashes Swick in the face, and Swick folds like a deck of cards. So, you know,
know, I mean, it was the kind of fight where one guy wins always in the first minute, and the other guy always, like, Yoshino Okami, all his fights are won in the third round or whatever. Plus, Okami has, like, twice as many fights as Mike Swick. He's got, mm-hmm. like 20 or 30 fights.
Plus, he's beaten like Anderson Silva once before, so.
Well, yeah, by a kick in the balls. I mean, Anderson Silva got disqualified for nailing him in the baby maker, yeah. You know? So I wouldn't really call that a win. I mean,
well,
if that's a win.
Technically.
Well, whatever. In that case, Anderson Silva can kick me in the balls, and I'll have a win over the UFC champion as well. I mean, you know?
Yeah.
I would call that a no contest.
No, I just thought it was funny because they kept mentioning that last night, but they didn't mention the fact it was a DQ, but yeah.
Yeah, they can spin that all they want, you know, like I say. I mean, somebody can come in and kick me in the nuts while I'm standing in the frozen food aisle at Safeway, and they can call that a win. I don't know, whatever, I'll take the paycheck.
I think the important thing to remember, too, though, and I'm not saying that you're not saying this, but just to make it clear that people listening, I mean, the guys like Mike Swick and George St. Pierre, these guys are young. I mean, they've got such a bright future, and that's another great thing about MMA right now is that despite the fact that you're going to lose, that no one's going to fight an undefeated, I mean, these guys still have 10 years of career ahead of them.
Yeah, I mean, look at when Josh Koscheck, he lost to Drew Thicket.
Yeah.
He was winning the whole fight, but then he got caught. MMA is a sport, you can get caught. That's just the way it is, and all you can do is keep plugging at it, you know what I mean? Like, it's not what happens on one particular night, it's what happens over the course of a career. I mean, Fedor lost a fight to Tsuchiya Kosaka by a cut, he came back and just beat the ever-living hell out of him. Mm-hmm. You know, it's what happens over the course of your career, not on individual nights. So, I mean, you see fights every now and then where George St. Pierre gets knocked out by Matt Serra or whatever, but I mean, most of the time, I wouldn't say they're flukes, but those are the less likely to happen than you know, if Sarah fights him again, you're probably going to see George St. Pierre take him down and pound him out. You know, that's just the way it is.
Yeah. Well, I think if you had bet $1,000 on Matt Serra last night, I think you would have made over $5,000, so.
Yeah, I think he was a -800, so.
I think it's plus 550, yeah, I can't remember what it was, but.
Oh, yeah, right, yeah, he was the plus. That's why I'm not one of the odds makers. I'm basically an idiot. I'm not very good at calculus.
You mentioned...
But yeah, if you put money on Serra, you're a rich, rich man, just like if you put money on Couture a little while ago, you're a rich cat for that. So, mm-hmm. I mean, Couture basically had the biggest upset in MMA for about a month, and then Matt Serra took it away from him.
Yeah.
So, very, very interesting. So we'll see what happens on the 21st in London.
Yeah, but, I mean, based on this theory, you should be betting your money on Gonzaga because there's so much riding on Krokop right now that the way things go for the UFC. Yeah. I wanted to talk about Pride a little bit, Wombat. You mentioned Fedor, et cetera, and I got to admit, between the UFC this week, there's an IFL last night, Bodog fight next weekend. I gotta admit, man, and family obligations with Easter, I didn't get the pay-per-view for Pride. And, you know, I'm a die-hard fan, and I'm the first to admit that probably if it wasn't such a busy weekend for me, yeah, I probably would have done it. But, dude, I gotta say, this card for the last DSC card that they promised a couple of huge surprises, etc., I don't know, man, I thought it was kind of a weak effort by...
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I was saying to my girlfriend that it looks like a moving out of our home yard sale or something. It was just kind of like they had some new fighters here, some old fighters there, some other guys they haven't talked to in a while, and they just kind of all put them out on their lawn and said, hey, and, you know, it's like when you go to a yard sale and there's like a box of records and it's like $1 just picked through them or whatever. That's basically what it was. It was weird. They had like Don Frye fighting...
James Thompson.
Just bizarre, like just weird. Like I don't know what the hell is going on.
Well, there was rumors this week it might be Vanderlei Silva at Igor Vovchanchin, and that might have swayed me into making myself available for sure to watch it.
Yeah. But he didn't even fight.
No, I didn't.
He didn't get cleared by the Nevada State Athletic Commission or whatever?
Yeah, and I think as well they probably just had trouble finding an opponent for him. And that's what I wanted to ask you, Wombat, is...
Vovchanchin hasn't fought in like 2 years. He's coming off back-to-back losses, for God's sake, to Alistair Overeem and somebody else. It doesn't matter. But, I mean, it's just weird.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, though, is, Wombat, do you think that the UFC, I mean, the Fertittas are the owners here, would they have any influence on this card? I mean, do you think that they might say, look, we don't want any of the big superstars competing on the official card to be run by DSC? Is that just to keep their options clear for their first show coming up?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I have no idea what kind of powers are going on behind the curtain, so to speak. But, I just know the card looked weird. And it looked like they were just kind of finishing up some shit. Like, if there's one guy had a fight left in his contract, and this guy here had a fight left in his contract, like, honestly, what they were probably doing is just kind of finishing up contracts with the guys that the Fertittas didn't want particularly, you know, in the UFC or didn't want to see American pride. It was just, you know, you had Gilbert Ivel was fighting on there, I think, and it was just Don Fry and Butterbean and Zula Zeno. It's like all these guys that, like if you were taking over somebody's house, you didn't like the wallpaper, you know what I mean? Or whatever, you just kind of rip it down and get rid of it, and it's out in the dumpster, and then somebody finds it there. That's kind of what the card looked like. It looked like sort of the leftovers or the weird, you know, the stuff that, you know, you open the fridge and there's some KFC and some Chinese food and some roast beef, and that's it, but you just kind of mix it all together and eat it because that's all the, you know, that's all that, all the food that's left or whatever. It just kind of looks like this weird kind of mishmash of stuff that didn't really fit together, and I don't know, I just kind of looked at it and I was like, what the hell are they doing? Like, Pride matchmaking has always been kind of weird, kind of like they just have a monkey picking names out of a hat or whatever, but like, this one was just truly, truly bizarre. And I think really what it was they just looked at all their contracts and they said, listen, we are obligated to give these guys one more fight, so let's just give them one more fight before, you know, Zuffa takes over, because, you know, or Zuffa said, listen, we don't want those guys, give them the fights, finish up their contracts, and you know, let's just clear their names off the list or whatever.
Yeah, because
realistically, if you look down that card, a lot of the guys on that card, I really don't see fighting in the future in Pride or the UFC, honestly.
Well, the other outside of the Soka Ju Arona fight, I wasn't terribly interested in a lot. I mean, Shinya Aoki is an amazing fighter to watch. They matched him up with a Dutch striker.
Just got out of prison in Holland or something.
Yeah. And then Zell Galasek, who's been nicknamed Little Crow Cop, fighting in Cage Rage over there in the UK. I was, you know, interesting to see him fight. But outside of that, I mean, you're right. There wasn't a lot to offer. And, you know, Soka Ju, and by the time people are listening to this, it won't be a spoiler, but in case you've got Pride tapes and you don't want to hear results, maybe turn off the show. Soka Ju knocking out Arona. This guy could definitely have a bright future. Back-to-back wins over two top-ranked Brazilian top-team fighters.
And that just goes back to what I was saying earlier. When you get an athletic guy that swings for the fences, people get knocked out. And it's so good, when you look at his boxing, it's not particularly great. He just goes completely ballistic. And he's only wearing a glove that, you know, a 4-ounce glove. So it hits you anywhere in the head, and you're done. That's just all there is to it. It's the same thing as like when Matt Serra fights or when Hermes Franca fights. These guys, they just swing for the fences, and all of a sudden you're waking up, you know, sucking the canvas, you know, and that's just the way it is. It's not that they have good boxing. They just throw with wild abandon, you know?
Wombat, you're a big jiu-jitsu guy. Your thoughts on Minotauro coming to the UFC? And at first, I got to admit, it took me a second to wrap my mind around it, why this was considered a big announcement, because obviously the Fertittas control Pride in the UFC now. But, and then it dawned on me, okay, well, this means that Minotauro is going to be fighting in the cage in the UFC for the majority of the time, unless there's the yearly championship fight or whatever they decide to do. But your thoughts on Nogueira coming to the UFC, and what was your thoughts on the reaction from the crowd? Did you think that they seemed like they were aware of who he was?
I don't know. I was pretty drunk when I was watching the UFC, frankly, so I didn't really, did the crowd boo or cheer or what? I mean, you're in Texas, for God's sake. You're interviewing a Brazilian guy in Texas. What kind of reaction are you going to get?
There seemed like there was people there who knew him. I thought the reception was actually better than when they brought out Vanderlei, a year and a half ago, into the UFC, and you could tell that there were some people there who probably had no idea who he was. I thought there was some reception to it, but...
Right, but I mean, in terms of how well he's doing the UFC, I think that his style of fighting would be better off in Pride, in a ring under Pride rules. Because in a ring, I mean, okay, in a cage, you're on your back, people can squash you up against the cage, and then you can't have that hip movement because they're all, like, right up in your grill, like Tito Ortiz or whatever, pushing you into the fence. Not that Ortiz is going to fight Nogueira, obviously, it's different weight classes, but it's just an example. So get off my back. Anyway, you know, when Nogueira gets pushed into the fence when he's fighting whoever, he's not going to have the hip movement to go for arm bars and triangles like you normally would. Plus, in Pride, going for a submission and not getting it, that's worth huge, huge points. Like when Nogueira fought Rico Rodriguez, and won, even though Rodriguez was in his guard the whole fight, punched him in the face. You know, in the UFC, that would have been a big loss for Nogueira, because he would have been on his back the whole fight, getting punched in the face, And so, I mean, is he a good fighter? Does he have good boxing? Absolutely. But I really don't think he'll do as well in the UFC as he would have in Pride, because now he's basically going to be fighting the same cast of the UFC that he used to fight in Pride. I mean, obviously, if you put him in the UFC years ago when the heavyweight division wasn't so good, he would have cleaned the whole place out. But now, if you put Nogueira in there against, like, Couture, if you put him in there against Krokop, or if you put him in there against whomever, he's going to have a much harder time beating those guys in a ring under UFC rule. I mean, in a cage under UFC rule, rules than he would in a ring under Pride rules.
Yeah.
And that's just the way it is, because he's that style of fighter. He's more of a mobility submission fighter, and those guys always work better in rings than in cages, because they can't get crushed up into the cage, and the rules are playing to their advantage as well. So we'll see. You know, we'll see. I mean, he's got really good hands, but I don't know, man. I don't know. That cage is the wall there, and you get pushed into that, and all of a sudden your submission options aren't there anymore.
Yeah.
You know, some guy's right up in your grill smashing you in the face. I mean, you saw what Couture did to Vitor Belfort. You know, he just pushed him into the fence, kind of knocked him down, and then kind of jammed his hips into Belfort's face. It looked kind of like something you'd see in a prison shower, but I mean, it did. It looked obscene. Couture was putting his baby maker right into Vitor Belfort's face for like 3 rounds, and he wasn't in Belfort's guard. He wasn't mounted on him. He was just kind of squatting over him in some weird kind of looking position, punched him in the face, and you know, and maybe he can do the same thing to Nogueira.
Well,
it'll
be interesting to see what they do with the scoring, because I mean, Dana White's already gone on public record saying that you know, it's going to be the Nevada State, New Jersey State rules brought into Pride, even in their shows in Japan, that there will be no more soccer kicks, no more stops, no more knees to the grounded opponent. But that is an interesting point. What are they going to do with the scoring? BJ Penn was on the show earlier this week, and I mean, he went on and on about how it's a joke that he favored the way Pride scores their fights, that UFC is, in his opinion, favors the wrestler too much, that you get points for takedowns, not enough points given for takedown defense, and furthermore, yeah, not enough points for submission attempts.
And remember, the UFC elbow is illegal, so all of a sudden the dude's in Nogueira's guard, and you know how Nogueira loves to lay there, look for the triangle, the umlaut of the arm bar. Well, all of a sudden he's laying there, people can elbow him in the face now. You can't elbow in Pride, man. He didn't have to worry about that stuff. He didn't have to worry about cuts, you know? So now in the UFC, he has the fence there, and he has to worry about getting elbowed in the face. Like, the guard is a much more viable position in Pride than it is in the UFC. I mean, yeah, they used to have stomps and whatnot, but that's if the guy stands up. But having a dude locked in your guard in Pride is not nearly as bad as having a dude locked in your guard when you're in the UFC, because he'll jam you into the fence and start elbowing you in the face. He will Ortiz you, if that is indeed can be used as a verb. And I can see that being a problem for him down the road as he starts to fight, you know, bigger and bigger guys in the UFC with a cage.
Wombat, last thing before we go, really quickly, your pick, Matt Lindlin versus Fedor Emelianenko.
Oh, man. You know, I mean, like I say, the mixed martial arts, I mean, you know, Couture beats Sylvia, Sarah beats St. Pierre. You know, that's why I keep, what the hell do I know? Because this sport is just, it's getting so unpredictable. It's just crazy. I mean, on paper, like everybody, it's Emelianenko. He's going to absolutely just smash him. But Matt Lindlin, I didn't think he was going to be able to beat Jeremy Horn. I didn't think Matt Lindlin was going to beat Carlos Newton, and he ended up submitting him. You know, I mean, Lindlin gets right in your face. He puts you on your back, and he just smashes the crap out of you. And he doesn't stop. He's got that smothering sort of cowboy tobacco juice in his mouth kind of thing going on, and you know, he's just on you like a rash for the whole fight. I mean personally, if I had to pick, I would go with Fedor, but I would like to say after I pick Fedor that I'm like, I don't really know what the hell I'm saying. I mean, I thought Sylvia was gonna knock out Couture. I was wrong. I thought St. Pierre would knock out Sarah. I was wrong. So really, at this point, I'm thinking Fedor is going to win, but hey, maybe I'm wrong. What the hell do I know? I'll buy a beer and watch it, I'll tell you that.
Well, I'd like to reiterate the fact that you are very often wrong, and I enjoyed saying that.
I'm not as wrong often as I am right. I'm still batting about 75-80%, so I'm pretty proud of that. But I'm wrong from time to time, and you know, hey, everybody's human, so, and it's MMA. You know, you flip two coins, who knows which one's going to come up heads or whatever.
Wombat, I'll never force you to change your prediction, buddy. You can take that to the bank. Huh? Does that make you feel better?
That's very nice of you. Thank you.
All right, Wombat. Well, you have a lovely remaining few hours of Easter Sunday, and we'll talk to you soon, buddy. Take care.
All right. Talk to you later.